It's odd that he felt drawn here, of all places, don't you think? As if he were looking for somewhere resembling the countryside of his own story.
Suppose he finds us?
Nonsense. Do you know how many villages there are along this coast?
Maggie shrugged her shoulders. He found you before, even when you were far, far away.
He found me with Dustfinger's help, and you can be sure Dustfinger isn't going to help him again.
Mo rose and drew Maggie to her feet.
Come on, let's ask Fenolia where we can stay the night. He looks like he could use some company.
Fenolia did not tell them whether Dustfinger looked like he had imagined him. He said very little as they walked back to his house. But when Mo told him that he and Maggie would like to stay there another day, his face brightened slightly. He even offered them a place to spend the night, an apartment he sometimes rented out to tourists. Mo gratefully accepted. He and the old man talked far into the evening, while Fenolio's grandchildren chased Maggie all over the nooks and crannies of the house. The two men sat in Fenolio's study. It was next to the kitchen, and Maggie kept trying to listen at the closed door. But Pippo and Rico always caught her in the act and dragged her away to the next flight of stairs before she had heard more than a few words. Finally she gave up. She let Paula show her the kittens scampering around with their mother in the tiny garden behind the house, and followed the three children to the house where they lived with their parents. They didn't stay long, just long enough to persuade their mother to let them stay at their grandfather's for supper. Supper was pasta with sage. Pippo and Rico picked the bitter-tasting green bits out of their sauce with disgusted expressions on their faces, but Maggie and Paula enjoyed the flavour of leaves. After the meal, Mo and Fenolio drank a whole bottle of red wine between them, and when the old man finally saw Mo and Maggie to the door, he said good night and added,
"So you'll look at my books as we agreed, Mortimer, and I'll get down to work first thing tomorrow."
"What kind of work, Mo?" asked Maggie as they walked along the dimly lit alleys together. Night had hardly cooled the air at all. A strangely foreign wind blew through the village, hot and sandy, as if it were carrying the desert itself across the sea.
"I'd rather you didn't ask me that," said Mo. "Let's just act as if we were on holiday for a few days. This looks like a good place for a holiday, don't you think?"
Maggie answered only with a nod. Mo really knew her very well. He could often tell what she was thinking before she put it into words. But he sometimes forgot she wasn't 5 years old anymore, and these days it took more than a few kind words to distract her from her worries. Very well, she thought as she silently followed Mo through the sleeping village. If he doesn't want to tell me what Fenolia's supposed to do for him, I'll ask old Turtleface himself, and if he won't say either, then one of his grandchildren can find out for me. Paula was just the right size for a spy. It didn't seem all that long ago since Maggie herself had been able to hide unnoticed under a table.
Chapter 28 Going Home.
It was almost midnight by the time Eleanor finally saw her garden gate beside the road. The lights down by the banks of the lake stood side by side like a caravan of glowworms, trembling as they were reflected in the black water. It was good to be home again. Even the wind that blew on Eleanor's face as she got out to open the gate felt familiar. It was all familiar, the scent of the hedges and the earth and the air, so much cooler and moister than in the south. It didn't taste of salt anymore either. I might even miss that saltiness, thought Eleanor. The sea always filled her with longing, though for what she was never sure. The iron gate creaked quietly as she pushed it open, almost as if it were welcoming her home. But no other voice would greet her.
"What a silly notion, Eleanor," she muttered as she got back into the car. "Your books will welcome you home. That's good enough, surely."
She had been in a strange mood even during the drive. She had taken her time on the way home, avoiding major roads, and had spent the night in a tiny place in the mountains, the name of which she had already forgotten. She had enjoyed being alone again, for that, after all, was what she was used to. Yet the silence in her car had suddenly begun to trouble her, and she had gone into a cafe in a sleepy little town that didn't even have a bookshop, just to hear other human voices. She hadn't spent much time there, staying only long enough to gulp down a cup of coffee, because she was annoyed with herself. "What's all this about, Eleanor?" she had muttered when she was back in the car. "Since when did you long for human company? High time you were home again, before you go right around the bend." Her house looked so dark and deserted as she drove up to it that it seemed curiously strange to her. Only the scents of her garden made her feel a little better as she went up the steps to the front door. The light over the door, which usually came on automatically at night, wasn't working, and it took Eleanor a ridiculous amount of time to get her key into the lock. As she pushed open the door and stumbled into the pitch-dark hall, she quietly cursed the man who usually kept an eye on the house and garden whenever she went away. She had tried phoning him 3 times before she set out, but she supposed he'd gone to see his daughter again. Didn't anyone realize what treasures this house contained? Of course, if they'd been made of gold, but they consisted only of paper and printer's ink. It was very quiet, and for a moment Eleanor thought she heard Mortimer's voice as it brought life into the church with the red walls. She could have listened to him for 100 years. No, 200, at least. "I must get him to read aloud to me when he arrives," she murmured, taking the shoes off her tired feet. "There must be some books he can read safely." Why had she never before noticed how quiet her house could be? It was silent as the grave, and the pleasure Eleanor had expected to feel as soon as she was back within her own 4 walls was slow in coming. "Hello, here I am again," she cried into the silence as she felt along the wall for the light switch. "Now you shall all be dusted and tidied again, my dears." The ceiling light came on very bright, and as Eleanor stumbled back in alarm, she fell over her own handbag, which she had put down on the floor. "Oh, heavens," she whispered, getting to her feet again. "Oh, dear heavens! Oh, no!" The custom-made bookshelves were empty. The books that had stood on them so safely, spine beside spine, now lay in untidy heaps on the floor, crumpled, dirty, and trampled underfoot, as if heavy boots had been performing a wild dance on them. Eleanor began to tremble all over. She stumbled through her desecrated treasures as if she were wading through a muddy pond, pushing them aside, picked one up and let it drop, staggered on down the long corridor that led to her library. The corridor was no better. Great, disorderly piles of books were heaped so high that Eleanor could hardly make her way through the ruins. At last she reached the library door. It had not been locked. Eleanor stood there for an eternity, weak at the knees, before she finally dared to open it. Her library was empty. Not a book in sight, not a single book, not on the shelves or beneath the broken glass of the display cases. There wasn't a book on the floor either, they were all gone. Instead, a red rooster dangled from the ceiling, stone dead. Eleanor's hand flew to her mouth. The rooster's head was hanging down, its red comb flopped over its staring eyes. Its plumage was still glossy, as if all the life in it had fled there into the fine russet breast feathers, the darkly patterned wings, and the long, deep green tail feathers that shimmered like silk. One of the windows was open. A black arrow had been drawn in soot on the white paint of the windowsill and pointed the way to the garden outside. Eleanor staggered toward the window, numb with fear. The night was not dark enough to hide what lay on the lawn outside, a shapeless mound of ashes, pale grey in the moonlight, grey as moth wings, grey as burnt paper. There they were, her most valuable books, all that was left of them. Eleanor knelt down on the floorboards, on the wood she had so carefully chosen. The wind wafted in through the open window and over her, the familiar wind, and it smelled almost like the air in Capricorn's church.
Eleanor wanted to scream. She wanted to curse, rage, cry out in fury. But not a sound came out of her mouth. All she could do was weep. Chapter 29. Only an Idea. The apartment that Fenolia rented to tourists was only two streets away from his own house. It had two rooms plus a tiny bathroom and kitchen. Since it was on the ground floor, it was rather dark, and the beds creaked when you lay down in them. All the same, Maggie slept well, or anyway better than on Capricorn's damp straw, or in the hovel with the ruined roof. Mo slept only fitfully. Maggie was woken twice on that first night by tomcats fighting out in the street, and both times she saw him lying there, with his eyes open, arms folded behind his head, looking at the dark window. He got up very early in the morning and went to buy food for breakfast in the little shop at the end of the street. The rolls were fresh and warm, and Maggie really did almost feel as if they were on vacation when Mo and she drove to the nearest town of any size to buy the basic tools of his trade, brushes, knives, fabric, stout cardboard, and truly gigantic ice creams, which they ate together in a cafe by the sea. Maggie still had the taste of the ice cream in her mouth as they knocked on the door of Fenolio's house. The old man and Mo drank another cup of coffee in his green kitchen before he took Mo and Maggie up to the attic where he kept his books. "I don't believe it," said Mo, outraged, standing in front of Fenolio's dusty bookshelves. "They should all be seized on the spot. When did you last come up here? I could scrape the dust off their pages with a trowel." "I had to put them up here," said Fenolio defensively, signs of a guilty conscience lurking among his wrinkles. "I was getting so short of space downstairs with all those shelves, and anyway my grandchildren were always pulling them around." "They could hardly have done as much damage as the damp and dirt up here," said Mo. Fenolio went downstairs again, looking crestfallen. "You poor child, is your father always so strict?" he asked Maggie as they climbed down the steep staircase. "Only about books," she said. Fenolio disappeared into his study before she could ask him any questions, and his grandchildren were at school or playgroup, so she got the books that Eleanor had given her and sat down with them on the flight of steps leading into Fenolio's tiny garden. Wild roses grew so thickly there that you could hardly take a step without feeling their shoots twine around your legs, and from the top step you could see the sea, far away, yet looking very close. Maggie opened the book of poems. She had to narrow her eyes because the sun was shining in her face so brightly, and before beginning to read, she looked over her shoulder to make quite sure Mo hadn't followed her down. She didn't want him to catch her at what she was planning to do. She was ashamed of it, but the temptation was just too great. When she was perfectly sure no one was coming, she took a deep breath, cleared her throat, and began. She shaped every word with her lips the way she had seen Mo do it, almost tenderly, as if every letter were a musical note and any word spoken without love were a discord in the melody. But she soon realized that if she paid too much attention to every separate word, the sentence didn't sound right anymore, and the pictures behind it were lost if she concentrated on the sound alone and not the sense. It was difficult, so difficult, and the sun was making her drowsy, until at last she closed the book and held her face up to its warm rays. It was silly of her to try, anyway. Very silly. Later that afternoon, Pippo, Paula, and Rico came back, and Maggie walked around the village with them. They bought things in the shop where Mo had gone in the morning, sat on a wall on the outskirts of the village, watched ants carrying pine needles and flower seeds over the rough stones, and counted the ships sailing by on the distant sea. A second day passed like this. Now and then Maggie wondered where Dustfinger could be, and whether Farid was still with him, how Eleanor was, and if she was beginning to wonder where they were. There was no answer to any of these questions, and Maggie didn't find out what Fenolia was doing behind his study door either.
"Chewing his pencil,"
Paula told her, when she had managed to hide under her grandfather's desk. "Just chewing the end of his pencil and walking up and down."
"Mo, when are we going to Eleanor's house?" Maggie asked on their second night, when she sensed that, yet again, he couldn't sleep. She perched on the edge of his bed. The bed creaked, just like hers.
"Soon," he said. "Go to sleep again now, okay?"
"Do you miss her? My mother, I mean."
Maggie herself didn't know why she asked that question out of the blue. All of a sudden, it was there, on the tip of her tongue, and had to be spoken aloud. It was a long time before Mo answered.
"Sometimes," he said at last. "In the morning, at midday, in the evening, at night, almost all the time."
Maggie felt jealousy digging its little claws into her heart. She knew that feeling. She felt it every time Mo had a new girlfriend. But how could she be jealous of her own mother?
"Tell me about her," she said quietly.
"I don't mean the made-up stories you used to tell." She used to search her books for a suitable mother, but there were hardly any mothers in her favourite stories. Tom Sawyer, no mother. Huck Finn, ditto. Peter Pan and the Lost Boys, not a mother in sight. Jim Button was motherless too, and all you found in fairy tales were wicked stepmothers, heartless, jealous stepmothers. The list could go on forever. That had often comforted Maggie in the past. It didn't seem particularly unusual not to have a mother, or at least not in the books she liked best.
"What do you want me to tell you?"
Mo looked at the window. The tomcats were fighting outside again. Their yowls sounded like babies crying.
"You look more like her than me, I'm glad to say. She laughs like you, and she chews a strand of hair while she's reading exactly the way you do. She's near-sighted, but too vain to wear glasses."
"I can understand that." Maggie sat down beside him. His arm hardly hurt him now. The bite from Buster's dog had almost healed, but there would always be a scar, pale as the scar Buster's knife had left 9 years ago.
"What do you mean? I like glasses," said Mo.
"I don't. Go on."
"She loves stones. Flat, smooth stones that fit comfortably into the hand. She always has one or two of them in her pocket, and she weights down books with them, especially paperbacks. She doesn't like the covers to stick up in the air, but you were always taking the stones away and rolling them over the wooden floor."
"And then she was cross."
"Oh, I don't know. She tickled your fat little neck until you let go of the stones." Mo turned around to look at her. "Do you really not miss her, Maggie?"
"I don't know. Well, only if I'm feeling angry with you."
"About a dozen times a day, then?"
"Don't be so silly."
Maggie dug her elbow into his ribs. They both listened for any sounds in the night. The window was open just a crack, and it was quiet outside. The tomcats had fallen silent, probably licking their wounds. For a moment, Maggie thought she could hear the sea breaking in the distance, but perhaps it was only the traffic on the nearby highway.
"Where do you think Dustfinger has gone?"
The darkness enveloped them like a soft cloth.
"I'll miss this warmth," she thought. "I really will."
"I don't know," said Mo. His voice sounded absent. "A long way off, I hope. But I'm not sure."
Nor was Maggie.
"Do you think that boy's still with him?"
"Farid. She liked his name."
"I expect so. He was running after Dustfinger like a dog."
"He likes Dustfinger. Do you think Dustfinger likes him?"
Mo shrugged his shoulders.
"I don't know who or what Dustfinger likes."
Maggie rested her head against his chest, the way she always used to at home when he was telling her a story.
"He still wants the book, doesn't he?" she whispered. "Buster will make mincemeat of him if he catches him. He must have gotten a new knife by now."
Someone was coming along the narrow alley. A door opened and was closed again. A dog barked.
"If it wasn't for you," said Mo, "I'd go back too."
Chapter 30. Talkative Pippo. The next morning at around 10 o'clock, Eleanor called Fenolio's house.
Maggie was sitting upstairs with Mo, watching him remove a book from its mildewed binding, as carefully as if he were releasing an injured animal from a trap.
"Mortimer!"
Fenolio called up the stairs.
"Come down at once, will you? There's some hysterical female on the phone, shouting in my ear. I can't make head nor tail of it. Says she's a friend of yours."
Mo put the book to one side, minus its cover, and went downstairs. Fenolio handed him the receiver with a gloomy expression on his face. Eleanor's voice was pouring rage and despair into the peaceful study. Mo himself had some difficulty in making sense of what she was saying.
"But how did he know?" "Oh, of course," Maggie heard him saying. "Burned? All of them?"
He passed a hand over his face and glanced in Maggie's direction, but she had a feeling he was looking straight through her.
"All right," he said. "Yes, of course, though I'm afraid they won't believe a word of it, and the police down here aren't responsible for what's happened to your books." "Yes, of course." "Naturally, I'll pick you up. Yes."
Then he hung up. Fenolio could not conceal his curiosity. He scented a new story in the offing.
"What was all that about?"
he asked impatiently, as Mo just stood there staring at the telephone. Rico was clinging to Fenolio's back like a little monkey. It was Saturday, but the other two children hadn't turned up yet.
"What's the matter, Mortimer? Aren't you talking to us any more? Look at your father, Maggie, standing there like a stuffed dummy."
"That was Eleanor," said Mo, "Maggie's mother's aunt. I told you about her. Capricorn's men broke into her house. They swept the books off the shelves all over the house and trampled on them, and the books in Eleanor's library."
He hesitated for a moment before going on. "Her most valuable books. They took them out into the garden and burned them. All she found in her library was a dead rooster." Fenolio let his grandson slide off his back.
"Rico, go and look for the kittens," he said. "This is not for your ears."
Rico protested, but his grandfather pushed him out of the room and closed the door after him.
"What makes you so sure Capricorn is behind this?" he asked, turning back to Mo.
"Who else would do such a thing? Anyway, as far as I remember, the red rooster is his emblem. Forgotten your own story, have you?"
Fenolio was looking downcast.
"No, no, I remember that," he murmured.
"What about Eleanor?" Maggie's heart beat anxiously as she waited for Mo's answer.
"Luckily, she wasn't back yet when it happened. She took her time going home, thank heavens. But you can imagine how she feels. Her finest books. My God."
Fenolio was picking up some toy soldiers from his rug with trembling fingers.
"Yes, Capricorn likes fire," he said huskily. "If it was really his doing, your friend can think herself fortunate he didn't burn her too."
"I'll tell her." Mo picked up a matchbox lying on Fenolio's writing desk, opened it and slowly closed it again.
"What about my books?" Maggie hardly dared to ask. "My book box? I hid it under the bed." Mo put the matchbox back on the desk.
"That's the one piece of good news," he said. "No one touched your book box. It's still under the bed. Eleanor looked."
Maggie took a deep breath. Was it Buster who had set fire to the books? No, Buster was afraid of fire. She remembered only too well how Dustfinger had mocked him for it. But in the last resort, it made no difference which of the black jackets it had been. Eleanor's treasures were gone, and not even Mo could bring them back.
"Eleanor is flying back down here. I'm supposed to pick her up at the airport," said Mo. "She's taken it into her head to set the police on Capricorn. I told her I don't think she'd have much luck. Even if she had evidence that it was his men who broke into her house, how could she prove he gave the order? But you know Eleanor."
Maggie nodded gloomily. Oh, yes, she knew Eleanor, and she understood her rage only too well. But Fenolio laughed.
"The police? You don't get anywhere by setting the police on Capricorn," he said. "He makes his own rules, his own laws."
"Oh, be quiet. This isn't a book you're writing,"
Mo interrupted him. Very likely it's amusing to invent a character like Capricorn, but believe you me, it's not in the least bit funny to cross his path. I'm off to the airport. I'll leave Meggie here. Look after her. And he was out of the door before Meggie could protest. She ran after him, but Paula and Pippo met her coming down the street. They caught hold of her, trying to make her go with them. They wanted her to be a cannibal, a witch, a six-armed monster, the characters from their grandfather's stories with which they populated their games. By the time Meggie had finally managed to shake off their little hands, Mo had long since gone. The place where he had parked the rental car was empty, and Meggie stood in the square, alone with the war memorial, and a few old men gazing out to sea with their hands in their pants pockets. Restlessly, she wandered over to the steps in front of the memorial and sat down. She didn't feel like chasing Fenolia's grandchildren around his house or playing hide-and-seek with them. She just wanted to sit there and wait for Mo's return. The hot wind that had blown through the village overnight had left fine sand on all the window-sills. The air was cooler than it had been for the last few days. The sky above the sea was still clear, but grey clouds were forming above the hills, and every time the sun disappeared behind them, a shadow fell over the village rooftops, making Meggie shiver. A cat stalked toward her, stiff-legged, tail erect. It was a thin little creature, with ticks in its grey fur, and ribs showing through its thin coat like stripes. Meggie enticed it over, speaking to it gently, until it put its head under her arm and purred, asking to be petted. It didn't look as if it belonged to anyone. No collar, not an ounce of fat on it, nothing to suggest it had a caring owner. Meggie scratched its ears and chin, and stroked its back as she looked down the road that went around a sharp bend as it left the village, and disappeared from sight beyond the houses. How far was it to the nearest airport? Meggie propped her chin on her hands. The clouds above her were massing more and more ominously. They loomed overhead, becoming closely packed and grey with rain. The cat rubbed against her knee, and as Meggie's fingers stroked its dirty fur, an awful thought suddenly occurred to her. Suppose Eleanor's house wasn't all Dustfinger had told Capricorn about. Suppose he'd also told him where she and Mo had been living. Would they find a heap of ashes waiting for them at the farmhouse? No, she wouldn't think about that. "He doesn't know," she whispered. "He has no idea." Dustfinger didn't tell him. She kept whispering it like a magic charm. After a while, she felt a raindrop on her hand, then another. She looked up at the sky. There wasn't so much as a speck of blue to be seen. How quickly the nearby sea could make the weather change. "All right, I'll just wait in the apartment," she thought. "We might even have some milk there for the cat." The poor thing weighed no more than a small damp towel. Meggie was afraid of breaking something when she picked it up. It was pitch dark in the apartment. Mo had closed the shutters that morning so the sun wouldn't make it too hot. Meggie was shivering and wet from the fine drizzle when she entered the cool bedroom. She put the cat down on her unmade bed, slipped on Mo's sweater, which was much too big for her, and went into the kitchen. The milk carton was almost empty, but if she diluted what was left with a little warm water, there was just enough for a saucerful. The cat jumped down so quickly when Meggie put the milk on the floor beside the bed that it almost fell over its own paws. Rain was falling, harder and harder outside. Meggie listened to it drumming on the paving stones. She went over to the window and opened the shutters. The narrow strip of sky visible between the rooftops was as dark as if the sun were about to set. Meggie went over to Mo's bed and sat down on it. The cat was still licking the saucer, its little tongue greedily rasping over the flower-patterned china, hoping for a last delicious drop. Meggie heard footsteps out in the street, and then a knock at the door. Who was that? Mo couldn't possibly be back yet. Or had he forgotten something? The cat had disappeared, probably to hide under the bed. "Who's there?" called Meggie. "Meggie!"
A child's voice called back. Of course, Paula or Pippo. Yes, it must be Pippo. They probably wanted to go looking for ants with her again, even though it was raining. A grey paw emerged from under the bed and patted her shoelace. Maggie went out into the tiny hall.
"I don't have time to play just now," she called through the closed door. "Please, Maggie," begged Pippo's voice.
Sighing, Maggie opened the door and found herself looking straight into Buster's face.
"Well, well, who do we have here?"
he asked in a menacingly soft voice, his fingers around Pippo's thin little neck.
"What do you say to that flat nose? She doesn't have time to play."
Buster pushed Maggie roughly aside and came through the door with Pippo, followed, of course, by Flatnose, whose broad shoulders would hardly fit through the doorway.
"Let go of him!"
Maggie snapped at Buster, although her voice shook.
"You're hurting him!"
"Am I indeed?"
Buster looked down at Pippo's pale face.
"Not very nice of me, is it? Especially since he showed us where you were hiding."
With these last words, he squeezed Pippo's neck even more firmly.
"Do you know how long we lay in that filthy hovel?"
he snarled at Maggie. She took a step backward.
"A very long time."
Buster emphasized the word, putting his foxy face so close to Maggie's, she could see herself reflected in his eyes.
"Isn't that right, Flatnose?" "Those damn rats almost nibbled off my toes," growled the giant. "Wouldn't I just love to twist this little witch's nose until it's pointing the wrong way around?"
"Later, maybe."
Buster pushed Maggie into the dark bedroom.
"Where's your father?"
he asked.
"This little lad," he said, letting go of Pippo's throat and prodding him in the back so roughly that he stumbled against Maggie, "told us he's gone out." "Gone out where?"
"Shopping."
Maggie could hardly breathe, she was so frightened.
"How did you find us?"
she whispered, but instantly knew the answer. Dustfinger. Of course, who else? But why had he betrayed them this time?
"Dustfinger," replied Buster, as if he had read her thoughts. "It's just too easy to find that fella. There aren't so many crazy jugglers in this world who go around breathing fire and who have a tame marten, not to mention one with horns, so we only had to ask around a little, and once we were on Dustfinger's trail, we were also on your father's, of course. We arrived just in time to see you drive away from the hotel parking lot, and we'd certainly have paid you a visit before now if this fool..."
he said, digging his elbow so hard into Flatnose's stomach he let out a grunt of pain,
"hadn't lost sight of you on our way here. We searched almost a dozen villages, wore out our voices asking questions, ran ourselves off our feet, until we finally got here. And one of those old fellows who spends all day staring out to sea remembered Dustfinger's scarred face. Where is he? Is he, out shopping, too?"
asked Buster, with a scornful twist of his mouth. Maggie shook her head.
"He went away,"
she replied tonelessly. "Ages ago." So Dustfinger hadn't given them away after all, not this time. And he'd slipped through Buster's fingers. Maggie could almost have smiled.
"You burned Eleanor's books,"
she said, holding Pippo close. He was still speechless with terror.
"You'll be sorry you did that."
"Oh, will we?"
Buster smiled unpleasantly.
"I wonder why. As far as I know, Cockerel had a lot of fun with those books, but that's enough talk. We don't have forever.
That boy," he said, pointing at Pippo, who retreated as if Buster's forefinger were a knife,
"has told us some strange stories about a grandfather who writes books and a book in which your father took a particular interest."
Maggie swallowed. Stupid Pippo, stupid talkative little Pippo.
"Lost your tongue?"
asked Bastard.
"Should I squeeze the boy's skinny neck again?"
Pippo began crying and buried his face in Mo's sweater. Meggie stroked his curly head comfortingly.
"His grandfather doesn't have the book you're thinking of anymore," she told Master. "You and your friends stole it long ago." Her voice sounded hoarse with hatred, and her own thoughts sickened her. She wanted to kick Master, hit him, stab him in the stomach with his own knife, the brand new knife he wore stuck in his belt.
"Stole it? Just imagine."
Master grinned at Flatnose.
"I think we'd better make sure of that for ourselves, don't you?"
Flatnose nodded distractedly, looking around him.
"Hey, hear that?"
There was a scratching sound under the bed. Flatnose knelt down, pushed the hanging edge of the sheet aside, and poked around under the bed with the barrel of his gun. Spitting, the grey cat shot out of hiding, and when Flatnose tried to grab it, the cat raked his ugly face with its claws. He leapt to his feet with a yelp of pain.
"I'll wring its neck," he bellowed. "I'll break that cat's neck."
Meggie was about to stand in his way as he lunged for the cat, but Buster got in first.
"You'll do no such thing,"
he spat at Flatnose as the grey cat disappeared under the dresser.
"Killing cats is unlucky. How often do I have to tell you?" "Nonsense, superstitious garbage. I've wrung several of the brute's necks already," said Flatnose angrily, pressing one hand to his bleeding cheek. "And has my luck been worse than yours? You could drive a man crazy the way you carry on. Don't walk in that shadow, it's unlucky. Oh, watch out. You put your left boot on first. That's unlucky. Oh, my." Someone yawned. "Mercy me, that means I'll fall down dead tomorrow."
"Shut up," snapped Master. "If anyone around here is talking nonsense, it's you. Get those children to the door."
Pippo clung to Meggie as Flatnose forced them out into the corridor.
"Why are you bawling like that?" he growled at the little boy. "We're off to see your grandfather now."
Pippo never let go of Meggie's hand once as they stumbled after Flatnose. He was clutching it so hard his stubby fingernails dug into her skin. "Oh," she thought, "why didn't Mo listen to me? We could have gone home." It was still raining heavily. Raindrops ran over Meggie's face and down her neck. The streets were empty. There was no one around to help them. Buster was walking just behind her, and she heard him quietly cursing the rain. When they reached Fenolio's house, Meggie's feet were wet through and Pippo's curls were plastered to his head. "Perhaps he won't be at home," Meggie hoped. She was just thinking about what Buster would do then, when the red door opened and Fenolio stood facing them.
"What on earth do you children think you're doing, running around in weather like this?" he said angrily. "I was just going out to look for you. Come on in and hurry up."
"May we come in too?"
Buster and Flatnose had been standing on either side of the door with their backs to the wall so that Fenolio wouldn't see them immediately, but now Buster moved up behind Meggie and put his hands on her shoulders. Fenolio stared at him in surprise as Flatnose stepped forward and planted a foot in the open doorway. Pippo scurried past him, nimble as a weasel, and disappeared into the house.
"Who are these people?"
Fenolio looked at Meggie as crossly as if she had brought the two strangers there of her own free will.
"Friends of your father's?"
Meggie mopped the rain off her face and looked back at him with equal reproach. "You ought to know them better than I do," she said. Buster's fingers were digging into her shoulders.
"Know them?"
Fenolio looked at her blankly. Then he studied Buster. His face froze.
"Great heavens above," he murmured. "I don't believe it."
Paula peered out from behind his back.
"Pippo's crying," she announced. "He's hidden in the cupboard."
"Will you go back to him?" said Fenolio, never taking his eyes off Buster. "I'll be with you in a minute." "How much longer are we going to stand out here, Buster?" growled Flatnose. "Until we shrink in this rain?"
"Buster," repeated Fenolio, without stepping aside.
Yes, that's my name, old man.
Buster's eyes always narrowed when he smiled.
We're here because you have something that interests us a great deal. A book.
Of course. Maggie almost burst out laughing. He didn't know. Buster didn't know who Fenolio was. How could he? How could he know that this old man had invented him? Made him up out of paper and ink, made up his face, his knife, his evil nature.
That's enough talk, growled Flatnose. The rain's running into my ears.
He brushed Fenolio aside like a troublesome fly as he pushed past him into the house. Buster followed with Maggie. Pippo was still sobbing inside the kitchen cupboard. Paula was standing in front of it, talking to him soothingly through the closed door. When Fenolio came into the kitchen with the strangers, she spun around and looked at Flatnose's face nervously. It was as dark and dismal as ever. Sitting down at the table, Fenolio beckoned Paula over without a word.
"Well, where is it?"
Buster was looking around, scanning the room, but Fenolio was too deeply absorbed in the sight of his two creations to reply. He couldn't take his eyes off Buster in particular, as if he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
"I told you, there's no copy of it here," Maggie replied for him.
Buster acted as if he hadn't heard her and gestured impatiently to Flatnose.
"Look for it," he ordered.
Grumbling, Flatnose obeyed. Maggie heard him trampling up the narrow wooden staircase that led to the attic.
"Right, little witch. How did you and your father find the old man?"
Buster prodded her in the back.
"How did you know he still has a copy?"
Maggie cast Fenolio a warning glance, but unfortunately he was as ready to talk as Pippo, who had so willingly told Buster all about her and his grandfather.
"How did they find me? I wrote the book," announced the old man proudly. Perhaps he expected that Buster would instantly fall on his knees before him, but Buster only gave him a pitying smile.
"Oh, yes, of course you did," he said, taking the knife from his belt.
"He really did write it."
Maggie couldn't resist saying so. She wanted to see the fear that had turned Dustfinger pale when he heard about Fenolio appear on Buster's face too, but Buster just smiled again and began carving notches in Fenolio's kitchen table.
"Who thought up that story?" he asked. "Your father? You think I look stupid? Everyone knows that stories in books are as old as the hills and were written by people dead and buried long ago."
He jabbed the blade of the knife into the wood, pulled it out and jabbed it in again. Flatnose was trampling around overhead.
"Dead and buried. How interesting."
Fenolio sat Paula on his lap.
"Did you hear that, Paula? This young man believes all books were written in the distant past by dead people who picked up the stories from heaven knows where, plucked straight from the air, maybe."
Paula couldn't help giggling. It had grown very quiet in the cupboard. Pippo was probably listening at the door, holding his breath.
"What's so funny about that?"
Buster reared up like a snake when someone has trodden on its tail. Fenolio ignored him. Smiling, he looked down at his hands, as if remembering the day when they had begun to write Buster's story. Then he looked straight at him.
"You always wear long sleeves, don't you?" he said. "Should I tell you why?"
Buster narrowed his eyes and looked up at the ceiling.
"Damn it all, why is it taking that idiot so long to find a book?"
Fenolio looked at him, his arms folded.
"Easy. He can't read," he said quietly. "You can't read either, unless you've learned by now. None of Capricorn's men can read any more than Capricorn himself can."
Buster drove the knife so far into the surface of the table that he had difficulty pulling it out again.
"Of course he can read. What are you going on about?"
He leaned threateningly over the table.
"I don't like the way you talk, old man. Why don't I carve a few more wrinkles in your face?"
Fenolio smiled. Perhaps he thought Buster couldn't hurt him because he, Fenolio, had made him up. Maggie wasn't so sure of that.
"You wear long sleeves," Fenolio continued very slowly,
as if giving Buster time to take in every single word.
"Because your master likes playing with fire. You burned both arms right up to the shoulders when you obeyed his orders and set fire to the house of a man who had dared to refuse his daughter to Capricorn. Ever since then, someone else has set the fire, and you confine yourself to playing games with knives."
Buster jumped up so suddenly that Paula slid off Fenolia's lap and hid under the table.
"Like to make yourself out to be clever, do you?" he growled, holding his knife under Fenolia's chin, "when all you've done is read the wretched book." "Well?"
Fenolia looked him in the eye. The knife under his chin didn't seem to scare him half as much as it did Maggie.
"Oh, I know all about you, Buster," he said. "I know you'd give your life for Capricorn any day, and you're always hungry for his praise. I know you were younger than Maggie when his men picked you up, and ever since you've loved him like a father. But shall I tell you something? Capricorn thinks you're stupid, and despises you for it. He despises you all, his devoted black-clad sons, although it's his own doing that you're still so ignorant. And he wouldn't hesitate to set the police on to any one of you if it was to his advantage. Are you quite clear about that?" "Hold your filthy tongue, old man!"
Buster's knife came alarmingly close to Fenolia's face, and, for a moment, Maggie thought he would slit his nose.
"You don't know anything about Capricorn, only what you read in this stupid book. I think I ought to cut your throat now."
"Wait!"
Buster whirled around to look at Maggie.
"And you keep out of this. I'll deal with you later, you little toad," he said.
Fenolia's hands were pressed to his own throat. He was staring blankly at Buster, having at last realized he was by no means safe from the man's knife.
"But you can't kill him. Really you can't," cried Maggie. "If you do..."
Buster's thumb stroked the blade of his knife.
"If I do, then what?"
Desperately, Maggie searched for the right words. What should she say? Or what?
Because... Capricorn would die too," she managed. "Yes, that's it. You'd all die, you and Flatnose and Capricorn. If you kill this old man, you'll all die because he made you up."
Buster's lips twisted in a scornful smile, but he lowered his knife, and for a moment Maggie even thought she saw a hint of fear in his eyes. Fenolia cast her a relieved glance. Buster stepped back, examined the blade of his knife closely as if he had discovered a mark on it, then rubbed it clean on the hem of his black jacket.
"Well, I don't believe a word of it," he said. "But this is such a weird story, I think Capricorn might like to hear it too. So," he added, giving the shiny blade a last polish before snapping the knife shut and putting it back in his belt, "we won't take only the book and the girl. We'll take you too, old man."
Maggie heard Fenolia draw in a sharp breath. She herself was so scared, she wasn't sure if her heart was beating at all. Take them away. Buster was going to take them away. No, she thought. Oh, please, no.
"Take us away where?" asked Fenolia. "Ask the girl here."
Buster pointed mockingly at Maggie.
"She and her father have had the honour of being our guests already, bed and board thrown in." "But this is nonsense," cried Fenolia. "I thought it was the book you wanted." "Then you thought wrong. We didn't even know there was supposed to be another copy. No, we were just sent to bring Silvertongue back. Capricorn doesn't like his guests to leave without saying goodbye, and Silvertongue's a very special guest. Isn't that right, sweetheart?"
Buster winked at Maggie.
"But he isn't here, and I have better things to do than hang around waiting for him. So I'll take his daughter, and he'll come chasing after her of his own accord."
Buster went up to Maggie and pushed her hair back behind her ears.
"She makes pretty bait, wouldn't you say?" he asked.
Oh, yes, old man, take it from me. If we have this little creature, we'll have her father, too. He'll come like a dancing bear led by a ring in his nose.
Meggie struck his hand aside, trembling with fury.
Don't you do that again,
Buster whispered in her ear. Meggie was glad that Flatnose came trudging downstairs at this moment. He appeared in the kitchen doorway, breathless and with several books under his arm.
Here, he said, dumping them on the table. They all begin with this single upright stroke, followed by the three up and down lines, just the way you drew it.
He put a stained piece of paper down beside the books. The letters I and N were clumsily traced on it, and it looked as if the hand that set them down had found the task very difficult. Buster spread the books out on the table and pushed them apart from one another with his knife.
These are no good, he said,
pushing two off the table so that they landed on the floor with crumpled pages.
Nor are these.
Two more landed on the floor, and finally Buster swept the rest off the table too.
Are you quite sure there isn't another one beginning like that?
He asked Flatnose angrily.
Yes, I'm sure. You'd better not be wrong, because I do assure you, you'll be the one to pay for it, not me.
Flatnose cast a worried look over the books at his feet.
Oh, and another little change of plan. We're taking him with us as well.
Buster pointed his knife at Fenolio.
So he can tell the boss his amazing stories. Very entertaining they are too, believe you me. And just in case he's hidden a book somewhere. Well, we'll have plenty of time to ask him about that once we get back. You keep your eye on the old man, and I'll watch the girl.
Flatnose nodded and hauled Fenolio up from his chair. But Buster reached for Meggie's arm. Back to Capricorn. She had to bite her lips to stop herself from bursting into tears as Buster dragged her to Fenolio's kitchen door. No, Buster wouldn't see her weep. She wasn't going to give him that satisfaction. At least they haven't got Mo, she thought. And suddenly there was only one thought in her head. Suppose he crossed their path before they left the village. Suppose he came to meet them on his way back with Eleanor. All at once, she couldn't wait to get away, but Flatnose had paused in the doorway.
"What about the little girl and that crybaby in the cupboard?" he asked.
Pippo's sobs died away, and Fenolio's face turned even whiter than Buster's shirt.
"Right, old man. What do you think I'm going to do with them?"
asked Buster scornfully.
"You say you know all about me."
Fenolio couldn't utter a word. Every cruel deed with which he had ever credited Buster was probably going through his head. Buster relished the fear on his face for a few delicious minutes. Then he turned to Flatnose.
"The other children stay behind," he said. "Our little madam here will do."
With difficulty, Fenolio recovered his powers of speech.
"Paula, go home," he said, as Flatnose forced him down the hall. "Do you hear? Go home at once. Tell your mother I've gone away for a few days, all right?" "We'll just look in that apartment again," Buster said as they were standing in the street outside. "I forgot to leave a message for your father. I mean, he ought to know where you are, don't you think?"
What kind of message will it be, thought Meggie, when you can scarcely write two letters together? But of course she didn't say so out loud. She was terrified the whole time that Mo might come to meet them. But when they reached the front door of the apartment, there was only an old lady walking down the street.
"One word out of you, and I'll go back and wring both children's necks,"
Buster whispered to Fenolio as the old lady slowed down.
"Hello, Rosalia," said Fenolio huskily. "Guess what? I have new tenants for my apartment. How about that, then?"
The suspicion vanished from Rosalia's face, and a moment later she had disappeared around a corner of the street. Meggie opened the door, and for the second time let Buster and Flatnose into the apartment where she and Mo had felt so safe. In the hall she remembered the grey cat and looked around anxiously. but it was nowhere to be seen. "The cat has to go out," she said when they were in the bedroom, "or it'll starve to death. That's unlucky." Buster opened the window.
"Right. It can get out now," he said.
Flatnose snorted scornfully, but this time he made no comment on Buster's superstitious nature. "Can I take some clothes?" asked Maggie. Flatnose just grunted, and Fenolio looked unhappily down at himself.
"I could do with a change of clothes, too," he said, but no one took any notice.
Buster was busy with his message. Carefully, with the tip of his tongue between his teeth, he was gouging his name in the wood of the dresser with his knife. Buster. Mo would understand that only too well. Maggie hastily stuffed a few things in her backpack. She kept on Mo's sweater. She was about to put Eleanor's two books in with the clothes, but Buster knocked them out of her hand.
"Those stay here," he said.
Mo did not return in time to meet them as they walked to Buster's car. All that long, endless way, he didn't appear. Chapter 31 In the Hills Dustfinger looked across to Capricorn's village. It seemed close enough to touch. Some of the windows reflected the sky, and one of the black jackets was repairing a couple of broken tiles on a roof. Dustfinger saw him wipe the sweat from his brow. The fools never took off their jackets, even in this heat, as if they were afraid of falling apart without the black uniform. Not that crows take off their feathers in the sun, either, and these men were just a flock of crows. Robbers. Carrion-eaters who like to plunge their sharp beaks into dead flesh. The boy had been uneasy when he saw how close Dustfinger's chosen hiding place was to the village, but Dustfinger had explained why there couldn't be anywhere safer to lie low among the surrounding hills. The charred walls were hardly visible, camouflaged as they were by the spurge, brambles, and wild thyme that had taken root among the soot-blackened stones. Capricorn's men had set fire to the house soon after taking over the deserted village. The old woman who had lived there had refused to leave, but Capricorn wouldn't tolerate prying eyes so close to his new hideout, and gave his followers free rein. His crows, his black vultures, had set fire to the homemade chicken run and the one-room cottage. They had trampled over the carefully tended beds in the garden and shot the donkey that was almost as old as its mistress. They came under cover of darkness, as usual, and the moon, so one of Capricorn's maidservants had told Dustfinger, shone particularly brightly that night. The old woman had tottered out of the house, weeping and screaming. Then she'd cursed them. She cursed them all. But her eyes were turned on only one of them. Buster, who was standing a little way from the others because he feared the fire, his shirt very white in the moonlight. Perhaps she had thought that shirt might conceal something like innocence, or a kind heart. At Buster's orders, Flatnose had put his hand over her mouth to shut her up. The others had laughed, until, unexpectedly, she fell down dead, and lay there lifeless among her trampled garden beds. Ever since that day, Buster had feared this place more than anywhere else in the hills. No, there could be nowhere better to keep watch on Capricorn's village. Dustfinger spent most of the time perched in one of the oaks that had once given the old woman a shady place to sit outside her cottage. Its branches hid him from the curious eyes of anyone who might stray up the hillside. He perched there, motionless, for hour upon hour, watching the parking lot and the houses through his binoculars. He had told Farid to stay farther away in the hollow behind the house. The boy had reluctantly obeyed. He was sticking close to Dustfinger, close as a burr, and he didn't like the gutted cottage. "Her ghost is still here for sure," he kept saying. "That old woman's ghost. Suppose she was a witch?" But Dustfinger just laughed at him. There were no ghosts in this world, or if there were, they never showed themselves. The hollow was so well sheltered that he had even risked lighting a fire the previous night. The boy had snared a rabbit. He was good at setting traps and more ruthless than Dustfinger. When Dustfinger caught a rabbit, he didn't take it out of the trap until he was quite sure the poor thing had stopped wriggling. Farid had no such scruples. Perhaps he had gone hungry too often. Above all, he loved to watch with wonder and admiration whenever Dustfinger took a few little sticks and lit a fire. The boy had already burnt his fingers playing games with matches. The flames had bitten his nose and his lips, yet Dustfinger kept finding him making torches of cotton wool and thin twigs. Once he set light to the dry grass, and Dustfinger grabbed him